Hello and welcome to The Stack. This week on the show, I speak with Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times between 2005 and 2020. He tells me all about his new book, reflecting on his time as editor. Plus, British artist Maggie Hambling and editor-in-chief of Middle Plain magazine, Ronnie Monhatt. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. To start the show, I speak with Lionel Barber, editor of the Financial Times between 2005 and 2020. Barber is credited in transforming the FT from a newspaper to a multi-channel global news organization. He also just published The Powerful and the Damned, Private Diaries in Turbulent Times, a look back at his time at the paper. Here is my chat with Lionel.
Well, I had a wonderful career, but as I say in the book, if you think about baseball, you want to go out on a home run. And I didn't want to be going out to the plate with rickety knees and a bad back and just not performing. And I'd done 14 years. And I wanted to go out on a high. And I think we did. We'd gone over 1 million paying readers. That was a huge landmark. We doubled the readership. I'd done some huge interviews, big exposés. And I'd just turned 65, so it seemed right. Yeah, I missed the American election. I would love to have been in the newsroom. But actually, overall, I'm fine.
Well, talking about the American election, it was very entertaining when you wrote about your interview with Donald Trump back in 2017. I mean, he's just such an interesting kind of character, you know, it's very odd. How was that experience in 2017?
Well, I tried to capture it afterwards with the two correspondents who were with me at the time. And I said, we've got to write down the 10 most interesting things. And I said, my headline is, this is like meeting Tony Soprano on the Potomac, because he's big, he's physically big, and he talks in a rather threatening way with a lot of okays as to force you to agree with him. And I also thought I was just stunned by how submissive his staff were. They all treated him like some medieval king in a medieval court. Otherwise, overall, I thought he was unreflective and quite a bit of a narcissist, but he also was a very effective communicator. He had great slogans like America First, and he did obviously achieve some things during his presidency. It wasn't all negative.
And it's interesting that I believe he mentioned something about the Financial Times when he said, you guys lost in a way, because, you know, I think the FT, you know, what it represents, I wouldn't say it would be the dream of the FT, a Trump presidency in a way, right?
When I entered the Oval Office and he said, have you been here before? And I said, yes, he seemed very disappointed. But I also said, thank you for seeing me and thank you for subscribing to the Financial Times. And he said, that's okay. You lost. I won. And he was making a big point about the bigger picture here, because he knew we hadn't backed him, but he also understood that the Financial Times was an important medium for his message to the world ahead of an important summit, the first meeting with President Xi.
Well, and that's precisely what the FT does as well, which is something that you can't read in other papers. Very recently, you'd had an exclusive interview with Vladimir Putin as well, with Angela Merkel. You have access to all the world's biggest leaders. I think that's something very much almost exclusive to the FT that you don't see in the other dailies sometimes.
Well, I tried to build on a legacy there and really use the access to get to the people who are making the big decisions. And it wasn't just about cozying up, or we weren't cozying up or getting too close. The fact is, it's a rare ability to get to the principle, to break through all the layers of PR-dom and look at power up close and personal. And that's what I tried to convey with the book. And I think with the FT, look, it wasn't easy with Vladimir Putin. It took more than 6 years to get that interview from when I first asked. You have to keep working at it, but if you want to try and seek competitive advantage in a crowded media market, it seems to me landing the big interviews with the big players is one way to do it.
And Lionel, just changing the story a bit earlier in your editorship, back in 2008, when there was, you know, the big financial crisis around the world, that must be quite a difficult topic to discuss at the Financial Times. How do you remember that period? I mean, and clearly the FT did well, even though it was a very challenging period for many.
Well, it was a unique opportunity, the biggest financial story in two generations. But obviously, we had to ask ourselves, and I asked myself, did we miss the forces that were building up to that financial crisis? I didn't dwell on it. I think we did send some signals, but like a lot of people, we failed to connect the dots. But after that, it seemed to me that we needed to explain the future of regulation. We needed to spot some of the gaps in that regulation, which had maybe encouraged people to take excessive risks. We needed to explain, and we also needed to understand, I think we did a good job largely here, was to understand there would be a political legacy, not just an economic recession, but a political legacy to the financial crash.
And Lionel, you were always as well like this kind of editor reporter. So, you know, you did quite a lot of the bigger interviews there at the paper. That's quite unique. You don't see every editor doing that. Was that always your intention? Because you have this passion not only to edit a newspaper, but also kind of to report it, you know, to go and practically do an interview.
Well, I believe in leading by example. I was a longtime foreign correspondent. I worked in Washington. I worked in New York as a writer and an editor. And I also worked in Brussels for 6 years. And, you know, I pride myself on my reporting. And I felt that it was a chance, not just for me, because I didn't do these interviews on my own. I always brought the reporter in and it allowed me to watch how they were performing. But I also felt that it was as if we were planting the standard around the world and showing what we could do. The role of, and I describe it as editor, reporter in the book, you've got to be very clear that when you're editing, you're editing. And if you do report, I never told the people who are editing my copy what to do. I let them edit. So these roles are separate, even if I managed to combine them. And lastly, you know what? I didn't want to sit staring at a computer in the office when history was being made. I wanted to get out a bit and meet people who are shaping history.
Well, absolutely. And let's talk about some of the other changes you've done since 2005 back at the paper. What do you think were the main changes? I mean, I'm just guessing here, but I think you kind of made the brand FT more global in a way. And I think that was shown in the type of stories you've covered. As a Brazilian living here in London, it was one of the few papers where I could actually see some coverage from Latin America. That was just not like one story every couple of weeks, you know what I mean?
Well, I inherited a paper that had lost its direction a bit in 2005. There were various reasons for that. We had wrongly overly focused on a declining circulation of the newspaper in the UK, and we called ourselves Britain's best newspaper. And I said, that's way too narrow. We should be the paper of globalization. We should be a global brand with a global presence and connect the dots around the world. And obviously the financial crisis came then and soon afterwards and vindicated that in a way. So I really did feel it was part of my duty to establish a global premium brand. So I also argued very strongly that we should raise prices. But I won't claim the credit for inventing the subscription model, which was the savior of the Financial Times. You know, I contributed to the debate, but there were other people on the commercial side who made the crucial decision in 2006 to actually charge for all content. And that was just massive. And then it was a question of tweaking the business model.
And Lionel, something a bit more recent, you know, I'm sure you're following as many people are, you know, the US election. Do you think this kind of potential victory for Biden will be kind of a return to normalcy, even perhaps a vision that perhaps the FT might approve, you know, some kind of anti-populism? But I wonder, perhaps it's still early days to discuss about this.
No, I think that Joe Biden is a centrist politician. He's not a national populist in the brand of Trump. And I speak to a Brazilian here, so like Bolsonaro or Duterte or Modi or Putin. Biden is very experienced, former senator. He served two terms as vice president. He's centrist. So the tone will change. And I think there will be certain moves like rejoining the World Health Organization. I think also he will maybe, he certainly won't be attacking NATO as before with Trump, but also he will have to deal with a Republican Senate likely, and he'll have to deal with the fact that America is very divided. So certain elements of Trump, and I think particularly the antagonistic policy towards China, will endure. It'll just be tempered by Biden.
We didn't talk too much here about the UK as well. What was your relationship with the prime ministers at the time? I mean, I have your book here in front of me. There's a quote of Tony Blair saying he thought the book was fascinating. Was it easy, that relationship, or were some of the prime ministers during your tenure that they were a bit more challenging, perhaps?
Well, it's interesting that Tony Blair actually did say my book was fascinating, but in the book, we describe how I ordered a deep investigation into his business ties and also what he was up to in the Middle East, where he's wearing several hats as a peacemaker for the Quartet, but also doing business there. And we effectively derailed his campaign to be the president of the European Council. I also was quite critical of Gordon Brown at times, and he certainly yelled at me, but at the same time, you give him credit for being a leader during the management of the global financial crisis. I think latterly, I'm very critical of David Cameron because I think he should never have called the referendum. He was cavalier in extreme. I wasn't impressed with Theresa May. She's not a natural leader. She got inherited very difficult political circumstances, but then made them worse by calling an early election. And Boris Johnson and I have known each other for nearly 30 years, and we're not friends, and I don't have much time for his ill discipline and his, shall we say, his economical attitude to the truth.
And Lionel, what's next for you? I mean, you left the Financial Times. Do you see yourself still doing something with journalism, or perhaps it's just a time to relax in a way?
No, I'm not a relaxing type. I'm doing anyway a monthly column for Nikkei in Asia. I'm started a new podcast with LBC, the major British commercial broadcaster, and I'm doing bits of writing and I'm doing some mentoring. I'm trying to help some younger people who, by giving some of my experience and one or two other things, and I'm still chair of the Tate Art Gallery. So I'm busy and I like to be busy.
That was Lionel Barber there, former editor of the Financial Times. His book, The Powerful and the Damned, is out now, published by Penguin Random House. And now to the art world. Monaco's Agustín Macellari spoke to British artist Maggie Hambling and editor-in-chief of Middle Plain magazine Ronnie Monhet on their new collaboration, Maggie's Mag. The issue reads as a visual interview of a photo series presented in a non-linear format that sheds light on Hambling's personality in varied ways. Each issue of Middle Plain features a guest artist. Previous issues were led by the estate of Felix González Torres and Vadim Zakharov. Here is Og speaking to both Maggie and Ronnie.
Middle Plain is fashion and art magazine. For each issue, we're inviting one artist to create with us an edition. The artists then invite fashion collaborators. And basically what we're doing, we are creating a visual interview. So we are translating the artist's practice into fashion editorial. We are looking at the fashion from the artist's perspective. So basically each time you're getting something completely different. Yeah, that's basically what we do. I think what's important for us is to kind of see how the artist is engaging with fashion, kind of putting it into a magazine format, which is in the end kind of an interesting result.
Maggie, to bring you into it then, you know, how have you seen the relationship between art and fashion? First of all, how have you seen it develop and how do you kind of understand it? Has fashion always played a role in your own practice?
Not at all. I think Oscar Wilde said fashion is whatever you're wearing at the time. And I've always rather agreed with that. But I mean, at my age and with my shape, it has been quite extraordinary to be approached first by the fashion house called Art School, who came to me and said they wanted to make jackets and dresses and all kinds of things with some of my Wall of Water paintings on them, as it were. And it was all rather a surprise to me. But they are very, very beautiful clothes made of marvelous silk and a reproduction. I mean, it's like walking, when I've worn their jackets, it's like walking around in one of my paintings. It's extraordinary, but they're beautifully made clothes. And as I say, it's a whole new experience. And then Middle Plain approached me. I'm not sure why, you'd have to ask Roddy about that. But so far, the collaboration has been pretty good. You know, it's been give and take and everybody's worked together fine. And then Jürgen Teller taking the photographs, that's a glass of water being poured. And I think it's all worked out. I'm really excited to see the magazine. I've seen, like you, a few some bits here and there, but to actually physically hold the magazine, I'm quite excited about it. I suppose it's because I'm so old, suddenly everybody's noticed me. You know? The thing about life, I started to paint when I was 14 and I'll be 75 on Friday. You just, the thing is, you just keep going. And then
something will happen.
Something happens.
That's very good. So tell me more about how the collaboration came about then. Ronnie, did you approach Maggie? Did you, you saw her work, you thought, I want to explore this a bit further in print?
I saw Maggie for the first time in the Oscar Wilde Temple. She did a talk there in Studio Voltaire. And then afterwards, we scheduled a meeting with her at her studio in London. And I think the minute I saw her, I said to myself, she looks like a very interesting person to work with. And in our first meeting, we knew it's a very, like, you know, it's a great fit. We already discussed ideas. Being in her studio was already kind of inspiring for us to take beats and do it as an editorial. So I think it was kind of natural connection with Maggie, which was kind of, you know, a quick one as well. And we straight away knew she's going to do a very good issue.
When I look at your work, Maggie, one of the things that I think about is not sort of, well, and if I think about fashion at the same time, I suppose I associate fashion with a sort of delicacy, a kind of expense, a carefulness, a fragility maybe. And then I think about your work, I think about the sea, I think about the Suffolk coastline, which I know certainly not as well as you, but which I visited. And it seems to be at odds. But I wonder if you do see a kind of, is there an overlap? And Ronnie, to bring you in as well, do you think that, like, are we perhaps moving away from the idea that fashion is sort of in some way more ephemeral, less kind of, has less of a physicality, and that perhaps there are overlaps between this visual description of a very, very powerful force and between the way that we kind of present ourselves and even interact with forces like that?
In Middle Plain's case, it's more about, in terms of when you're speaking about fashion, it really depends on how the artist is looking at fashion. I feel like, you know, all the time it's really important for us to look at the artist's material, like we look at Maggie's subjects she's dealing with, her painting, her personality as well. And I feel like fashion could be so many things that in the end you're getting this like completely different result than you plan to. And for me, what was important is that in the end, when you flip through the pages, you'll feel that Maggie's there. Although, you know, it's a completely different way to look at Maggie, I think, through fashion editorials. And I think fashion could be a lot of things. In our case, it was those editorials you're seeing and kind of like experiencing the artist in a bit of a different way than we're used to.
Yeah, I would say that. It's been a whole new experience to me. And what I'm excited about is that this, I mean, the previous issues which I looked at, I mean, they're very beautiful objects in themselves. And it's very important that it's a real magazine. You know how everything now is on the web and up in the air and somehow coming through the airwaves. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as with my paintings, I mean, that somebody actually is in the physical presence with the paintings. I mean, is so crucially important that there's a physical object of a painting on the wall and somebody physically experiencing it. And I feel the same way about this magazine, that it's something that people can hold in their hands. And of course, my work features in the magazine, my work as well as this whole new world of fashion to me, you know? It's a whole new thing, but it's exciting.
I wanted to pick up on that, Maggie, and ask what it did for you looking at your work in this kind of new situation, not just on its own, but, you know, you're posing with it in places as well. Did it change your view on your practice at all?
Well, no, I think I've done exactly the same thing every day since I was 14. That's when art began for me. When I was 14, I get up very early in the morning and make a drawing, and some of these drawings have been made into a very beautiful book called Quotidi, and it's a very, very beautiful book indeed, a selection of these drawings. For the last 2 years, I've drawn with the stopper of the bottle of ink with my left hand, and they've been celebrated in this book, which is part of the magazine as well. And so my work is there just as much as my prancing around for Jürgen, being a fashion model when I'm quite the wrong shape and rather the wrong age.
Actually, Maggie's very photogenic, by the way. We feel like we can definitely photograph a lot of images of Maggie.
What was it like working with Jürgen Teller? Was he pushy? Was he a gentle hand on the tiller?
Well, I met Jürgen several years ago with Sarah Lucas at parties in Suffolk, and I'd always been rather frightened of him. And then he came to photograph me for, I think, a magazine called Pop. And he came to my studio in Suffolk. Mm. And we got on like a house on fire. And he'd always apparently been rather frightened of me. So these two people, but first, I mean, for a couple of years, rather nervous of each other, realised they had so much in common. And so making photographs with Jürgen is terrific, because he's a friend. And I think he's an artist of photography, definitely. There's sort of no feeling of artifice about his photographs, sort of not enough touching up as far as I'm concerned. What you are is what he photographs, you know. We had some fun with it.
Yeah, definitely.
And Ronnie, I noticed, you know, flicking through this, the PDF, I should say, you talk about this sort of this visual interview. And indeed, there is very little text in the magazine. There's only really a letter written by, I think, you to Maggie. What does that omission of text, what does that leave space for?
I think that when we researched about Maggie, we learned about her a bit more than we knew, was the fact that she did so many interviews, mostly written, and we wanted to kind of take a fresh approach on how we are presenting Maggie. And for us, the most obvious way to do a magazine is through editorial. So we decided to kind of try and take it to the most radical side then and only present her through visuals, even for people who not necessarily know Maggie. I feel like when you're flipping through the pages, you can know who is Maggie. You can learn more about her. And I feel like he gave us a kind of a fresh approach on how we're dealing with the artist and fashion, which I think kind of created for us, it's our best issue yet, because it kind of, with Maggie, we succeed to execute our concept kind of in a good way.
I think it's great to have a magazine that's mostly nearly all pictures.
Yeah. People prefer to, like, you know, look a picture rather than read long text.
I mean, it makes for something almost a fantasy, but something exotic and something mysterious. And people can sort of see in these pictures whatever they like, you know, rather than being, you know, having sermons kind of made to them all the time of what they should be thinking and what they should be understanding. You know, when you look at a visual thing, it's up to the person looking at it to find whatever they find in it. We're all different, you know, in the wave paintings, which you mentioned earlier, you know, people saw faces, they saw animals, they saw figures. But I was unaware of those things happening in the paintings when I was making the walls of water, because a painting, when it works, it always feels nothing to do with me. It takes over and it paints itself. The feeling as if something else made the work rather than me, which is, that's when it's really working. I'm only responsible for the bad ones, which I destroy. But when the painting paints itself, then it's fine and it's okay. And I think it's great to have this very different and kind of pure magazine. I don't think there's enough purity about it. I don't mean morals. Do you know, a pure visual thing that is a beautiful thing to look at is something original.
Finally, just to wrap things up, I have to know, were those meringues homemade?
Yeah, they were. The photographer, Paul Quaker, decided to cook it himself with his girl. So he cooked it overnight and he shot it throughout the week. Yeah, it's a good question, by the way, because they definitely don't look like someone bought them.
No, they certainly
My sculpture of Henrietta eating meringue is in the magazine. So the meringues do happen to be my favorite cake. Right. I did notice a total lack of cream in those meringues.
Yeah, you
so
did.
I was having
you
to did. Lick them and eat them with no cream. Think of that, which is part of the point, the difference of the texture of the cream and the meringue. But there we are, you know, I just do what I'm told. I've spent my whole life doing exactly what I'm told.
Well, and we must suffer for our art, mustn't we, as well?
Yes.
That was Maggie Hambling and Ronnie Monhead speaking with Augustine Macellari. Maggie's Mag is out now. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hull. If you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to the show again on monaco.com. And please subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. And to end the show, one of my favorites by Madonna, it's Material Girl. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.